This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
The Buddha said there were three main realizations, or sometimes what we refer to as insights or awakenings, that led him to liberation, the core characteristics of our experience, referred to as the three characteristics, that is, applies to all of our experience. And that is that everything is impermanent. You can reflect on that for a moment. Can you find any permanence anywhere, internally or externally? Sometimes things seem pretty permanent, like structures. Physical things seem pretty, like, that's a fucking pretty solid. Seems pretty permanent. And then you go to Rome, you see the Colosseum or something, and you say, well, yeah, it's still there, but it's in such a state of decay. I was in Cambodia a bunch of years ago, and there's Angkor Wat and all of these ancient Buddhist sites. My favorite one was one called Angkor Thom, where rather than fully restoring it, they left like all of the trees growing through the ruins. And so you go and you wander through it, and there's these, you know, temple ruins. But there's just these massive, now hundreds of year old trees growing right through this place that was like a major civilization. And so impermanent, sometimes it's quite obvious to us, and we think, yeah, of course, everything's changing. And sometimes we really can get deluded by how slowly things change sometimes, how long it takes a structure like this to crumble. But without maintenance, this structure will be impermanent, will crumble over the decades, over the centuries. And mostly, we're investigating the internal. I think actually really reflecting on everything outside of us is impermanent has been so helpful to me too. Many of you have heard me talk about my relationship to material things. Because, you know, a core reason that we're understanding is impermanence is so that we don't get attached to impermanent things. So we don't, because attachment will create suffering for us. But then there's the dilemma of, well, okay, I don't want to be attached, but I want to have stuff. I don't want to suffer about my stuff, but I want to have stuff. I want to enjoy the car, the motorcycle, the clothing, the whatever it is. Record collection, I want to have stuff. I'm not a renunciate, I haven't given up my stuff. I cherish my stuff. But where's that balance of having stuff that you know is impermanent? And actually seeing it as impermanent. And so many of you have heard the famous teaching that I like to talk about. I don't feel like I've talked about it in a while, but from Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield's teacher, Ajahn Amara, my teacher's teacher, Thai Forest monk, who's, you know, over and over he's saying, impermanence, impermanence, impermanence. Don't cling to anything. And then somebody says, but it looks like you're kind of attached to your favorite water glass. Poor guy, right? He's got nothing, and somebody's giving him a hard time about his relationship to his water glass. And he says, I like this. This is my favorite glass. And but my relationship to it, this is, I'm quoting him, is that it's already broken. I understand its impermanence so deeply that I appreciate every moment that I have with it, and I understand that eventually I'll knock it off the table and it will break, or, you know, what other elements, we'll get to it, that I'll be separate, or I'll die, like I'll be separated from this material thing. It'll break, I'll, you know, someone will steal it, I'll die. I don't get to keep this. And I was so inspired by that teaching of trying to look at my stuff in that way. Uh, 15 years ago, I was in New York City and I brought my 1964 Chevy Impala Super Sport lowrider with hydraulics and a fresh paint job, and I thought it was a good idea to bring it to New York City. It was like, when I finally got some money, first thing I did is I went out and bought a lowrider. And it was my prized possession. I've been meditating for a lot of years. And at some point in New York, my mechanics were fixing my suspension. And the suspension broke, or something happened, and it hit the ground on one of those big metal plates, and the big kind of construction plates. And there was a kind of a metal skid bar on the frame, because when you bounce it, so that it hits the bar instead of the frame. And it tore my frame in half. And just basically totaled my precious Lolo. And I had been trying to have this perspective around myself. Like, yeah, it's my, you know, it's the thing that I wanted, and I got it, I saved for, and I brought across the country when I moved across the country, and now it's not there. And how am I going to relate to this impermanent, you know, possession? Am I going to suffer about it? Is anger the appropriate response? Is grief the appropriate response? Is murder maybe an option? Should I? And to trying to have that, and I mean, I can look back and say, I suffered a little bit about it, but not a lot. I think I would have suffered a lot if I hadn't been meditating for a lot of years at that point. If I hadn't understood impermanence and seen it already as something that was impermanent, I think I would have suffered a lot. I suffered a little bit. I won't say that I was totally free from suffering. But just such a decrease in the amount of suffering I could have had. Actually, I saw my progress when I was sharing what had happened with someone else. And they said, you seem so okay with it. How could you be okay with it? Like, I would murder, is what this woman that I was sharing it with said. She's like, I would kill. Actually, what she said, I see that you're actually, there's this tattooer at this tattoo shop I was hanging out with. She said, I thought Buddhism was just a way for you to pick up on chicks. She said, I didn't think that you were really like a Buddhist. I just thought that was like the t-shirt you wore. She said, and then your car got thrashed and you didn't suffer that much about it. And I realized you actually meditate. Because I would have suffered so much, is what she was saying, if that happened to my car. But you were kind of like, oh, yep, happened. Sucks. Some grief around it, some... So that understanding of impermanence, not just about mind states arising and passing, but really internally and externally. I mean, it's such good news about our mind states. Half of the time, impermanence is really good news, right? When life is painful, when an afflictive emotion is here, we're grateful for impermanence. Like, this is going to pass. And sometimes it feels like a curse. Impermanence is not such a... not so happy about the car getting wrecked or the relationship ending or finances changing for the, you know, loss. Or impermanence sometimes feels so painful. So much grief and loss around it. Sometimes it's a relief. I feel like I'll spend the rest of my life, and I encourage you also to spend the rest of your life reflecting on this truth and looking in each moment that we're not at ease, when we're relating to some impermanent pain or some impermanent possession or some impermanent relationship or some impermanent experience, and we're suffering about it, to really wake up and remind ourselves, yes, of course, this is a law. This is not optional. Can I have awareness of this? Can I be in harmony with it? Can I have that understanding that the glass is already broken, that the lowrider is already wrecked, that the relationship is already over? That our loved ones are already dead. That they are impermanent. And that when they die, we say, of course, they are impermanent. Death is certain. Loss is inevitable. And rather than it being some kind of like doom and gloom, depressing thing of just, it's just reality. I'm not making it, right? We're not making it up. What's the alternative? The alternative is how most of us live most of the time, which is denial. Being asleep to the reality that death, change, impermanence is inevitable. The end, the beginning, birth equals death. Equals impermanence. In the meditation instruction, the first foundation of mindfulness, pay attention to your breath and your body and reflect on the impermanence of this body itself. Know that this body will be a corpse and that everybody else will be a corpse. Not as a depressing death rock. You know, I'm not trying to get all super creepy on you. Just as the reality of impermanence. And so liberating. And actually, when we turn towards impermanence and death of all things, it makes life more precious rather than depressing. Rather than taking it and going into a like darkness about it, or kind of a, you know, kind of depression about it, of just being like, wow, it makes each breath more precious, each moment more precious, each relationship, it makes everything more alive, actually, when we're not in denial about the unreliability, the uncertainty of continued existence for our friends or ourselves or our stuff. Core insight that we're looking for. You can't think your way, right? So, and this is why we meditate, because you all. I mean, does anybody not get it? It's so simple. You get it. So straightforward. It's hard to argue with. Like, yeah, of course. But intellectually grasping it and accepting it is much different than actually living in harmony with it, because we seem to be born into this body that takes everything personal and clings. I heard once somebody say that we're not actually human beings. We're not that good at being. We're clinging. We're craving human clingings. Human, you know. What we're actually mostly doing is attaching to impermanent people, places, things, experiences. We're not very good at just being with the process that's passing through. So, and it's why we meditate. Meditation gives us this insight so that we know it and so that we live in harmony. We come more into balance. We begin to let go. We begin to accept. We begin to relax a little bit. Rather than trying to control everything and rather than denying what's actually happening here. Anicca is the term for impermanence. And then the second thing the Buddha says is liberating insight is anatta. And it's why I asked you at the anatta translates as no, not self, or not personal, or no permanent self can be found in this human experience. That's why I asked this at the end of the meditation. Who, investigate a little bit, who are you? Where's that feeling? We all have the I, me, mine, self feeling. But in meditation, in investigation, when you turn your attention, where is it? Where is the I? Where is the me? Where is the mine? Can you find it? So I want to do a little practice with you, and I want you to count on your fingers. In your mind, and use your fingers to do 10 things that you identify as yourself. I am... get 10. I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a punk rocker, I'm whatever, you know, whatever. I'm sexy, I'm whatever. 10 ways, you know, think about the way that you think about yourself. Who are you? What are 10 things that you identify with in your life? I'm straight, I'm gay, I'm trans, I'm black, I'm white, I'm tattooed, I'm, you know, can you get 10 things? I'm going to try to do it with you. Sometimes I'll do this practice in dyad, where I'd actually make you turn to somebody and then ask the person the question, who are you? And then they have to answer it. And you say, I'm Noah. What a stupid question. I'm a male. I'm a Buddhist. I'm a teacher. I'm a father. I'm a son, I'm a brother, I'm a sister. But like after they ask you like 30 times, you're like, I don't know. Stop asking. I'm nobody. That under investigation. And you, this is like, I can tell you what the teaching is, but it's, all of this is to be known directly. Buddhism is not theoretical. It's not a faith to believe in. It's not a religion to believe in, as far as I'm concerned. This is directions pointing us towards experiencing for ourselves, investigating for our not selves. Directly. Can you find a self? Are you your... You don't have to answer, these are rhetorical questions. Are you your personality? Do you even like your personality? A lot of who we actually identify with are things that we don't like about ourselves, right? I'm this thing that I don't like about my mind. I'm this thing that I don't like about my body. I'm not the, you know, I'm that love handle. That's me. I am. Reflecting on it. Who are we? Why do we take everything so personally? Why are we so convinced that it's all about us all of the time? Our whole life, right? Everything's sort of revolving. It's a story about me and the relationship and the world, and the mind is just constantly giving us this message of you, I, me, mine. Self-centeredness is normal. The belief that we are some sort of permanent being is normal. There's some way that we're just born into this mind that thinks about itself all the time and identifies with a lot of, isn't almost everything that you listed from the past? Like if you had to erase, if you had no memory, and you were, if you were really fully in this moment, how would you know that you exist? Who would you be if you lost your memory completely? If you didn't have any of the past experiences to reflect on, and you're just here now. How many of that list goes away? Okay, I'm not a punk rocker, but I'm not any of this stuff that I've been identified with my life, that I remember the 1980s. If I don't get to remember that, who am I? Who am I now here? What can I say for sure is true in this moment? Sensations? It's kind of like almost that's it. There's sensations. There's awareness. Consciousness. And there's memory, right? Like in this moment, there is. We have a brain and it remembers. I'm a conscious sensory being that remembers and has some perception of pleasant memories, unpleasant memories, pleasant sensations, unpleasant sensations, neutral. What seems to be true is that the feeling of I'm the same person that I was and that I'm the kind of sum of all of my experiences is created by having a physical form and having a brain that has consciousness and memory and perception, awareness, creates the feeling of, it's the memory. I remember my traumatic experiences that created my neurotic personality. And that's who I am. I remember the traumatic experiences that I've been defending myself against and reacting to and shooting dope about. Part of the key here, I know this gets a bit esoteric or something, but part of the key here, again, is coming back to impermanence. Sometimes in Buddhism you will hear, you will read, people will say, there is no self. In Japanese Buddhism and Zen, they love to bring this anatta teaching to, there's no self. I totally think there's a self. There is a self. I am. You are. You are you, I'm me. But the self, the I, is a process that's unfolding, that's constantly changing. It's not static. It doesn't not exist. It exists. The I, the feeling of I, exists. It's a real feeling created by memory and perception and sensation and awareness creates I. Now you can remove One of those, if you remove any of those factors, remove your memory, you won't feel the way you feel about yourself. Remove consciousness, you won't be aware of yourself. Remove perception. I mean, the I takes all of these physical, psychological, consciousness, memory, in order to identify as the I, the me, the mind, takes all these factors. So part of what the Buddha is saying here is not that there's no self. Part of what he saw is not that we don't exist. It's not that this is all a fantasy or an illusion. This is real. These are real sensations and real thoughts and real feelings and real perceptions. Well, some of your perceptions are real and some are delusional. But perception is real. They're not all right. They're not all correct. But we have perception. Waking up to the impermanent nature of all things includes waking up to the impermanent nature of self. We are an unfolding process. The past is a memory. And we can become so identified, so attached to our past. So much suffering. Now we need to tend to the sorrow, to the grief, to the trauma that we've been through that's living here in the present in our bodies. I don't think we need to use this kind of teaching as a bypass, as an avoidance, as a suppression, as a just ignore the past. Actually, the past is here. Right? It's living in your cells. Your years of alcoholism is here. Living in your cells in the present, even though you've been sober for 2 weeks or 20 years or whatever it is, it's still here, living in the present. Anicca, anatta. Now, a simpler way to think about anatta or not self, and the way that I often like to think about it, we could turn the AC back on. It did get hot, and I can be loud enough. Another way that maybe is more practical. I don't know how it resonates for you, to thinking about who are we and the self and not a permanent self, an impermanent process unfolding. Maybe that's useful to reflect on. I encourage you to continue to reflect on that question over your life, over your meditation, over your practice. I think a way that I've found a lot of liberation in of not taking everything so personal is seeing that this is the human condition to take everything personal. That it's not even your fault that you're self-centered. Even that is even self-centeredness is impersonal. It's just the human condition. It's not our fault that we think about ourselves all the time. It's just what the human mind does. That's not self. It's not you doing that. It's just what this animal does. Millions of years of evolution, creation of a neocortex, this big human brain with consciousness, and a survival instinct that craves for pleasure and thinks about itself all the time. It takes everything personal all the time. Not your fault. Not personal. You're not doing it all wrong. Life is living through us. It is not so personal. Now, we do have some free will. Maybe. Some of us do. Everybody does. I mean, the human potential is, okay, how am I going to relate to this mind? Am I going to let this mind lead me through my life, chasing pleasure, of trying to avoid pain, denying death, being asleep? Or am I going to turn towards my mind and turn towards reality and try to see it clearly and try to choose, have some freedom of how I respond? And this is all of what Buddhism is directing us to, a wise relationship to the impermanent self, a seeing clearly of the reality that the self is a changing process and that the mind has a mind of its own. It's just not who we are, and it's just not reliable, and a lot of the time it's not trustworthy. I started with introducing ourselves to each other. I think it's a core aspect of Sangha, is that we need to check in with each other about our thoughts. My mind just told me something ridiculous. Can you believe it? And I thought I might be right for a minute. Having that humility to not believe the hype of our own minds. To wake up to the impersonal and often ignorant tendency of the human mind. Conditioned ignorance, things we've been misinformed about, religious oppression, racism, sexism, homophobia, stuff that your mind is doing that you were misinformed about, the ignorance that you were taught. That you somehow took on, and now your mind is doing that, and you know, oh, where's that racist thought? Where's this white privilege coming from? Oh, I was conditioned with it. I wasn't paying attention to it. I didn't even see it until I started to really investigate what it's like to be a white person. I only recently realized I was white. It was an unpleasant insight. And only a white person can deny that. And just seeing that conditioning, suffering, denial, ignorance. So the impersonal, I find that a little bit more palatable. Does it sound not your fault? It's human condition. Don't take it so personal. We're only that easy. This is what it's like to have a mind and a body. And if we practice diligently, if we meditate, if we turn towards it, if we investigate, if we question, we can begin to respond more wisely to a mind that is born with some level of ignorance. Some of our ignorance is conditioned. Some of it is natural, byproduct of birth, like the craving for pleasure and the idea that pleasure is going to somehow make you happy. It doesn't understand impermanence, and it's why craving is so repetitive. Nobody had to teach you that. You're just born with that survival instinct, and you've been taking it personal and satisfying it, chasing one fix after another. Whether you've become a drug addict or you're just, you know, looking for it in material and, you know, sensual experience. So the third liberating truth, the Buddha said, I saw the impermanence of all things. I saw how impersonal it all really is. How there's not a permanent self to be found here. Just the human condition unfolding. Said, and then I reeled through understanding impermanence and impersonal, I came to understand that the satisfaction that we are seeking in impermanent, sensual, material, relational happiness is not going to be found. That there is no sensation that will ever satisfy us because it's impermanent. There's no material thing that will ever satisfy us because it's impermanent. That the only satisfaction that we can find, the true end of suffering, the true happiness, the true well-being, is living in harmony with impermanence and not taking it all so personally. Relating to everything as already broken, as already dead, as unreliable, and totally enjoying the unreliable, impermanent experiences. Totally enjoy, not avoid, not being like, well, this relationship's going to end, so I'm not going to start it. This relationship is totally going to end. Let's go for it. With our eyes open to impermanence. With our eyes open to the grief that we're both signing up for. The pleasure, the joy, the sorrow, the loss that we're both signing up for as we enter into a relationship in an impermanent world where even happily ever after one of us dies first and has to grieve the other's loss. Dukkha is the term for it, so it's anicca, impermanence, anatta, not self or personal, and dukkha. And so the dukkha in this context, the first noble truth, many of you know the term dukkha, the first noble truth, there is suffering in life. So sometimes dukkha is translated as suffering or stress or real difficulty. I mean, in this context, it's not even saying that life is painful or suffering all the time. It's just saying unsatisfactory, that you're not going to find satisfaction outside of yourself. But that inside, in our relationship to things, in our relationship to sensations, in our relationship to relationships, there is a way to be completely satisfied and totally in harmony with impermanence and at ease and meeting pain with compassion and meeting pleasure with non-attached appreciation and not taking anything that's not personal, personal. And there's some discernment, right? Like some shit's personal. But having that discernment around your mind and what thoughts to trust and what thoughts to not trust, what's Mara arising in the mind, the unwise aspects of mind, what is Buddha, what's awakened thought, what thoughts are actually allies, what is wisdom? Coming to a level of understanding and discernment where there's a sense of well-being, of satisfaction, that's not relying on sensual material. Buddha says the highest form of happiness is the happiness of integrity. Of blamelessness. It's not material happiness. It's not sensual happiness. It's karmic wholesomeness. When we live our life in such a way that we're not creating harm to ourselves or others, we're being honest, we're being careful, we're being wise, then we have no regrets, we have no shame, we have no guilt, because we're really in integrity. So that's the kind of satisfaction that we're able to obtain. Blameless behavior, speech. I feel inspired just talking about it. I don't feel like I'm there at all, but I feel inspired as I remind you and I remind myself of what we're actually doing here. And what the potential is for us with this, with the Dharma, with applying the Dharma, with the meditative awakening that we can have. I want to say a couple more things, and then I'll open for questions. I'm not sure why, but when I was thinking about talking about this earlier, I really felt like in order to really discuss impersonal and not self, we also have to bring in karma. Because I feel like too many people have focused so much on the impersonal, and they've used it to justify bad behavior. This is not personal. There's no self. It's not self. It's okay. So, in balance with our understanding of impersonal, there is this, and maybe it's a contradiction, but I think it fits. There's also the understanding that we, this process that we are, is a process that is totally responsible for our own behaviors. That's why blamelessness and integrity is so important, because we don't get away with anything, ever. All of our actions we own, karmically inherit how we behave. Now the good news is, no matter how poor we've behaved, unskillfully, karmic purification can be done in this lifetime. This is the Buddha's original teaching. Full liberation available to everyone in this lifetime. Later, Buddhism started to switch it. I believe later it happened. I believe that the Buddha's core message was liberation is available here and now in this lifetime. Purification, forgiveness of yourself and others in this lifetime. Living in integrity in this lifetime. Ending suffering in this lifetime. Later, Buddhism started to get into like, yeah, be a kind of a good person and you'll have a good rebirth. And kind of putting it out like, and after eons and eons of being a good person, maybe you'll get enlightened. You'll have a good rebirth. Maybe that's true, but I feel more inspired, and I look at early teachings that the Buddha wasn't, this is not about a good rebirth. This is about ending suffering in your life now. And that's what I'm motivated to do. I'm not motivated by what happens after I die. I'm motivated by what happens right here and now while I'm alive. There's the five reflections that many Buddhists do on a regular daily basis. That's, you know, you reflect. Maybe you'd say this every morning as part of your meditation or ritual and say, I'm of the nature of aging. I'm not exempt from aging. I'm of the nature of sickness. I'm not exempt from sickness. I'm of the nature to die. I'm not exempt from death, from impermanence. I will be separated from everything that I cling to, that I hold near and dear, everything that I love, I will lose. Just reminding ourselves this. And finally, most importantly, I think, on some level, my actions are my only true possessions. My actions, my karma, is the only thing I really own. It's the only thing that I really own. It's the only thing that cannot be taken from me, from outside of me. It's the only thing that I really own, and that even if rebirth is what's happening here, it's the only thing we take with us. We take our karma into our next life, if there's a next life. Wherever you land on this reincarnation business, up to you. Maybe it doesn't make any sense to you. And I don't think you need to believe in rebirth to see the importance of karma and personal responsibility, and that we are creating our realities based on how we respond to what's happening in our life. All right, that's what I wanted to share with you tonight. Does it make sense?
Yes.
Any questions or comments or anything? Please. Well, like taking this view, it's not your fault that your mind does that. It's impersonal that the mind resents betrayals, losses. The mind just does that all by itself. So the more you see that and you more say, oh, look what my mind is doing again, rather than what I am doing. So part of that insight is like, it's not me. It's just what my mind's resenting that person again, or that situation, or... And then maybe underneath it, there's sadness, there's grief, there's feelings of betrayal, of loneliness, whatever it is. And tending to it, relating to it, is where we bring mindfulness to it and compassion. And then we say, okay, I'm going to start, now that I'm really aware of it, I'm going to start replacing it with forgiveness. I'm going to start training my mind to meet it with forgiveness, meet it with compassion. Compassion for how much pain I'm in about the loss, with the betrayal. I'm going to start trying to replace those thoughts with some friendly thoughts, with some compassion and forgiving thoughts. And I'm going to fail. It's having the humility. I'm going to try and I'm going to fail. I'm not going to perfectly replace the resentment with forgiveness all at once today, but that's my intention. So I'm going to start trying to meet that repetitive resentment with some compassion and some forgiveness. And maybe it's going to take me months to actually get some success in forgiving him, her, them. And maybe it's going to take years, but I'm committed to not suffering, so I'm going to start sending forgiveness, and maybe it's going to take a long time. And eventually, the end of that relationship is going to arise, and your mind, and rather than hatred, it's going to be met with compassion. Because you will train your heart and your mind to do that, if you're motivated to do it. Jake, did you raise your hand? No. Huh?
I was just
oh, you're. Please.
I was curious about the opposite, like when you're trying to nurture a relationship, where attachment falls in to that spectrum, and where to draw line to yourself.
You know, it's really helpful if both people have some wisdom and both understand impermanence and emotional intelligence, and that there will be moments of being so connected and so beautiful and intimate and depth, but that don't get attached to it always being like that, because understanding that in these two different desire systems and conditioning, that there will also be moments where one of us is in a bad mood. And it's not their fault. And you don't have to take it personal, right? And you don't have to fix it. And, you know, so like being in a relationship where there's space for each of us to be our own unfolding process together, rather than this. My parents wrote a book about relationships, and they said most people are like, you make me happy, I make you happy, and it's this real, you know, kind of insular, you're responsible for my happiness, I'm responsible for your happiness. Now, of course, in the Dharma, we understand, no, I'm responsible for my happiness, you're responsible for your happiness. But not so. And we can share that, right? And we can share the intimacy and the love and the connection of that. They said, their view was, try to make your relationship more of a triangle, that we're both responsible for our own happiness and we're connecting here, but we're also going for a greater good. We're mutually connected to our service, to our awakening, to our Dharma practice, that it's not just such a... one-on-one thing. It's like, no, we're together and we're supporting each other in our individual responsibility for our own happinesses. And, you know, we do give each other pleasure, and we do inspire, and I like the way you look at me, and I like, you know, like all of that. I feel good, or, you know, hopefully in the relationship, it feels good to be seen and cared for. And so you nurture all of that while still saying, and I'm fully responsible for my reactions. You're still fully responsible for your reactions, all of that. I'm still going to have bad hair days, bad moods. And knowing that intimate relationship cannot be everything. It's a part of life. Does that make sense? Is that what you were asking?
Yeah.
Is there anything more specific about it?
No.
I don't know if you've seen me before. I think that what I tend to do, is I try to practice non-attachment in an intimate, loving relationship. And, you know, and this is not attachment, it's connection, embracing. And then sometimes I cling, they cling. And then, you know, there's a bit of a controlling and clinging. There's a bit of a don't change. There's a bit of denial of impermanence. I wanted to stay just like this. Or a little bit of a, like, could you be a little different than you actually are? And then sometimes there's an overcompensation from clinging. Instead of going into non-attachment, it goes to detachment. A resentment, kind of like, now I'm separate from you. And then a coming back together into non-attachment. But non-attachment is connection. Or ideally, it's connected, non-clinging, loving. I'll even use the term embracing without controlling. That's the ideal. And that usually we're doing this dance of kind of separating, coming back together, clinging, waking up to that hurts, I don't like it when you control me or I'm controlling you, or and then you separate and you come back together. And the ideal is live in a non-attached, loving, connected relationship. But none of us can really do that. And so we dance. We'll end here with mostly just want to say you're in the right place and you're doing the right thing to break that totally impersonal, habitual tendency of self-centeredness. Not your fault. It's not that you did something as a kid to start, you know, it's just what the human mind does. All of us have done the exact same thing. Mindfulness wakes us up to it. And mindfulness breaks our addiction to it and our identification with it. And it's not that somehow we meditate our mind into stop thinking about itself. We just stop taking it so personally. And you'll develop more and more ability to choose not to pay attention to it when your mind is obsessing about the future or the past, self. The more you live in your body, the more you see that stuff is just in the background, the less personal we take it. Mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, will lead directly kind of these liberating insights of not self, of impermanence. So this is the path that will heal this human condition that you and I and everyone else in the world was born into. Does that make sense to you? This is it. I mean, this is all of what the Buddha is talking about. And mindfulness is the main meditation technique that will lead to that. And you have to take it seriously, and you need to start sitting every day, and you need to go on some retreats, and you need to have the humility to know it's not going to change overnight. And it'll take a process of years of practice to loosen that identification. And we'll continue to suffer in the meantime, in the process. But that 10 years from now, if you meditate every day, you won't be so self-centered. Really, I mean, and I don't, not, you know, not all of us, less and less self-centered. And more interest in others and connected and empathetic. And your mind will still think about itself, but you just won't be so involved in it. I like to say that. Give it a decade. Practice every day for a decade. See what happens. Thank you for being here tonight. Thanks for listening to my teachings. All of what I share with you, although I believe it's pretty much in line with early Buddhism, some of it's also my opinion and my personality presenting it, and that really it's your duty as the listener to find out for yourself what's true and to trust your own direct experience through investigation and through experience rather than believing teachers. Teachers are also unreliable. So thank you for your attention, your practice.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.